Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 506. And I'm joined today by someone who's been requested loads, even though they've already been on. It's Raoul Reynolds of Enter Shikari. And I need to tell you a little story here, because Raoul was on back in 2015. And at the start of that episode, I said, hey, man, because we'd chatted a bit, but normally online. And we've continued that, but normally online. I was like, hey, man, I'm never sure how to say your name. Is it Raoul or is it Roo? And he told me, it's Raoul. Raoul like cow, not Roo like moo. Now, the problem with that rhyme is cow and moo are quite similar, so it's hard to know which one's the right one. So before this podcast, I thought, I'm going to go back and listen to check how I say it. And in the intro of that podcast, I get the example the wrong way round. I say it's Roo like moo, not Raoul like cow. So for this episode, despite it being heavily discussed in the past, I call him Roo up until the point he refers to himself as Raoul at one point. Bless him, he doesn't correct me. But the fact is, I actually went back and did the research. But idiot me in 2015 got it wrong in the intro, even though I'd just been told it's Roo like moo, not Raoul like cow. And in the intro, I go, joined by Raoul, Roo, it's Roo like moo, not Raoul like cow. So I just say it completely the wrong way around. So just as a little insight to everyone, the way I'm remembering it is Raoul like aroused, because Raoul is a very sexy man. So Raoul like aroused, not Roo like ruined. Now that's because that can be used in anyway. I don't know where I'm going. My head's all over the place. It's a wonderful chat. I think you're going to really enjoy it. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch. And patreon.com/ScroobiusPip, which is where you can support the podcast for around $1 or $2 a month. And that helps pay the best producer in the game, Buddy Peace, who I was going to ask. I was going to do a recording now of me going, Raoul, 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 and ask him to edit in the correct pronunciation every time I said Roo. But I decided it's best to be honest with these things. Openness and honesty is important. So there we are. But yeah, I think you're going to really enjoy this. And as I said, on the Patreon, you can support, help pay Buddy, help pay John Harris, help pay Jared, the people who are behind the scenes on this beast. Jared Robinson, as I full named John Harris. I shouldn't be vague on these things. This intro makes no sense. Thank you all for tuning in these past few weeks. And I'm glad you have been, because I'm not really on socials at the moment for reasons I won't go into. But one thing that's kept me on socials in the past is the fear that everyone will miss the podcasts, and I have a responsibility to the guests I have on, who are kind enough to give me their time to promote the episode to get as many people as possible listening. And I've not really been doing that because I've not really been, as said, on socials. But there's been loads of you listening. I mean, I'd love it if you lot, even in lieu of me posting anything, ramped up word of mouth if you really enjoyed an episode. If you tag me and stuff, I'll still probably see it at some point. I'm popping on and off. But yeah, anyway, this is episode 506 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Raoul Reynolds of Enter Shikari. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Let's do all the catching up on the record. I'm joined today by Reynolds of Enter Shikari. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Yeah, we're in cloudy Wolverhampton, about to play the second show of the second leg of our UK residency tour. And I feel a bit less stressed than the first leg. So I'm happy.
Where are you in Wolverhampton? I went to uni in Wolverhampton. I dropped out after a year, but I did go to uni. I attended some classes, so
I lived there exactly for a bit. Exactly the same as me. Yeah, I did the year and then ran away. We're doing, what's it called? The Steel Mill. KK
yes.
Steel Mill, is it? Yes.
Yeah.
I should know it, as we only played it 4 weeks ago. But
I'm sure that was where I first saw Head PE.
Okay.
Of all bands, or Head P, depending on different people's pronunciation, in really in the depths of my nu metal era. And their DJ would skateboard around the stage in between in between his sections, which was
awesome.
A hell of a thing. what did you do at uni for a year before calling it a day?
I did music, technology and composition at Hertfordshire. But yeah, basically that was just when the band was like really kicking off and we were taking on tours that meant I was skipping so many classes. And then it just got to the point where I was like, okay, can I have a year out? And then that got to the point where as well, actually, can I have 2 years out? No. And so that was it.
That feels like it's a course that's the name of that course looks like it's literally what you have to do to be the front man of Enter Shikari.
Yeah.
it kind of covers all the bases. I love it.
But the thing is, I think the second year would have been much more interesting, but I didn't really learn much from the first year. I remember the classes where I was taking the Akai, the like original Akai sampler. We had a whole section on that, and that was awesome. Quite difficult, but awesome. But yeah, other than that, it was just like, oh, not really getting much out of this.
Yeah,
I just want to be playing shows.
I had the same, man. I was doing photography, and I think anything in the arts, it's such a weird one to be graded in as such, because the arts are so subjective. And for me, uni was great because they had equipment I couldn't afford. So I could use a dark room. I could use all these big Hasselblad cameras and all this dope stuff, which I would never have been able to get my hands on. But from the creative point of view, kind of sounding similar to you and the band, all the best work I did was nothing to do with uni. I was doing loads of photography that wasn't part of my course, but using all their kit and then almost phoning in the bits that were there, kind of, here's what you need to do to get a grade. And yeah, I did a year of that. And obviously we're going to talk a lot about society and governments and stuff. And I was just not comfortable getting in that much debt for an education. I did the first year. It was just after the grants had been stopped. I did the first year and I was like, man, this is spinning me out to be potentially coming out of this tens of thousands of pounds in debt.
Yeah, it's wild. And it's only got worse since.
it's got a lot worse since. But speaking of time passing, you're one of the most requested guests that I've already had on this podcast.
Oh, wow.
because you came on so long ago, I have you and Sarah Pascoe are two that people often say, oh, you should get them on. I'm like, yeah, I should, but you know they've been on, right? Go back and listen to that, because it was in 2015, which is the year before everything started going to shit, really. And I mean, I'm sure if you listen to that episode, we will be talking as if everything has already gone to shit. But it was 2016 that was Brexit and Trump and Prince died and Bowie died. And it's such a mad year for bad things happening. It's really, I get a bit of insomnia and often I'll go off on spirals of like, that's got to be the year that we went into some kind of simulation, right? Because it was too much crazy shit all at once. So I mean, how have you been? How were you going through that year? I know, as someone who is very politically conscious, someone who is an artist and has to kind of try and draw something from these times, all of those things at once are a lot, because there was a lot going on politically and a lot of, as said, amazing musicians leaving this earth. So, have you got many memories of 2016? It sounds like a weird one to throw at you, but... Yeah, how was that period?
That was like a really disorientating, frightening time for me personally as well, because I was like going through a breakup from like a 7-year relationship. My nan died. My nan was like a pivotal person in my life, lived with us for many years. And I had like the first panic attack that I realized was a panic attack. I had insomnia, didn't sleep for a week, you know, like that. The sort of 2015, 2016 period was just mental for me. So I ended up, that's why I wrote the Spark, our album, which is kind of our most, well, for me as a lyricist, like personally revealing. Because I felt like I finally, almost like I had, someone had given me the okay that I can now write about personal things because enough shit has happened to me sort of thing.
So
there's only like, for instance, on that album, there's only really one overtly political track, which is Take My Country Back, which is obviously inspired by Brexit and everything that was going on, and just that general kind of shrinking of the world and that outlook that the problems are out there, you know, and just blaming everything on people from other countries, other cultures, whatever. But the rest of the album was kind of, it was still political, because I believe what I was, you know, all I was saying was that, like, I'd come to the conclusion, or no, not the conclusion, the realization that we're fragile creatures, incredibly fragile creatures, but we're, especially as males, and especially as British males, we're forced to think that we're not fragile.
Mm.
And so that was what a lot of that album was about. And I think that in a way it was political, because at the, you know, at that time we were experiencing Trump, and, you know, there's a man who's incredibly fragile, but has been told from birth that he can't be. So he's just morphed into this, you know, monster. So yeah, it was like a weird marrying of like personal disasters and like social disasters.
It's weird how those things can come along at the same time in your personal existence and in the grander societal existence. I saw a friend, someone who's a pal and I think has got a good outlook and everything, doing a post about the war against masculinity recently. And I was like, ah. Like, it's not like someone who I know social, like on social media. I was like, I didn't think that was you. And it got me thinking about it a lot, because I think that obviously the war on masculinity is some dumb shit, but also I think it's so dumb because I think we're at a time where masculinity is embraced more than ever. It's just not based on gender. Like, masculinity and femininity are both things that should be embraced more than ever, but we shouldn't be, it's not restricted to the traditional male and female genders anymore, you know? And
yeah,
it makes it so dumb that there's this war on masculinity, when I've got loads of gender free friends, or people of varying genders, non-binary friends and all like sorts of things like that, that embrace masculinity. Yeah. Mm. It's seen it because there's also men who are embracing, admitting weakness, admitting their feelings, admitting, you know, all these personal things. It's then seen as this attack on masculinity. It's like, no, it's just you're worried about men not being like you used to think of men. That's the reality of this. It's not masculinity that's a threat. It's your idea of a male.
Yeah, it's like this traditional sense of the male. It's like this warped, reduced version, you know, whereas a male should only act in these ways and only show these specific emotions. You know, usually some form of anger is the only like allowed emotion, you know, traditionally, especially in kind of Victorian Britain.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's strained when, I mean, for instance, you know, we just talked about Bowie and Prince. Like, these are people like for decades have been like trying to expand, you know, whether it was subconscious or conscious, trying to expand what masculinity is or should be. And we're still having, you know, the same problems and the same
fight.
But
that's the thing. It's not even the steal. It's the mistake, like the inaccurate thing put forward at the moment is that all these changes in trans culture and all these things are new and they're bad because they've come out of nowhere and they're this new thing. The idea of two genders is the new thing. There's like throughout in all sorts of societies, there's been multiple genders and all things like this. And the big thing at the moment that drag is dangerous for children, like they need to ban drag book readings, all that kind of thing. It's like, motherfucker, widow twanky. Like, we literally, I went to pantomimes, all of us went to pantomimes as a kid. There's drag is a key part in pantomime. It was never any threat, any risk, any danger. It's the thing that is new isn't drag queens doing readings to kids. It's people thinking there's anything fucking dangerous about that, or sexualizing drag as a default. Like, I agree that we shouldn't have sexual performances for young children.
Yeah.
Regardless of gender, regardless of choices, regardless of anything else. It's this weird thing. It blows my mind that people get hung up on all these, as said, these new things. As someone pointed out, that in Big Brother Series 3, I think it was, Nadia, a transgender woman, won Big Brother Series 3 or 4, decades ago, and it wasn't a big deal. There was, obviously she got a bit of backlash, but she was adored and it was a positive thing that she was accepted for who she is, all this stuff. It's like, it's really recent history that we're turning on all these things and thinking all these things are bad. And Bowie and Prince are prime examples there. These absolute fucking icons who were, Prince in particular, I don't associate a gender with Prince. That's a being. That's just this. That was this amazing creature. Yet, as said, it's all seen as these modern wokeness and all this other bullshit. Yeah. It's really interesting how these things are so easily framed in the media without really any scrutiny. Like the smallest scrutiny, you go, oh no, look, 15 years ago, no one had a problem with this. The problem that's new.
It seems to be that sort of the classic, or one of the classic faults of social media, that it amplifies the extremes to the other side, you know, the other political side. So, you know, the people who they see that one video where that, you know, there was someone doing some kind of sexual performance and there were kids there, and then they're like, right, everyone now is tarnished with that brush. Every performance is obviously like that, and their view is just completely warped. But because that's what social media does, it amplifies the extremes to everyone, you know, regardless of your point of view. The things that are going to get the clicks are the things that are, whoa, that's fucking insane, I'm going to retweet that. And everyone else sees it and they retweet it, and then therefore they think, oh, well, that's obviously the norm, when actually that was just like the one, you know, in a million things that was like that. Yeah, it's wild, man.
It's such a weird one, man. I mean, social media is something that you address in the new record. It's one of the topics that you talk about. What is your current relationship with social media? Because it is such a weird dichotomy. There are these, I'm currently off social media. Like I'm not engaging at all. And it's a weird one because it's come about because of reasons I didn't expect, if you know what I mean. I won't go into it, but I've been saying for years I need to get off of it. And then I've kind of dropped off. But I know from following you and being a similar kind of social media user to you at times, that it's been really important to me for getting causes across, for getting petitions signed, for getting, you know, protests, all sorts of things. Where do you sit on the positives and negatives of social media, I guess?
I feel like my general view is becoming increasingly negative. You know, even from just like small scale, like personal experience, you know, I feel that like most people, they follow, you know, people that they respect or support or whatever, and they probably don't realize that those people have exactly the same reaction on social media to you in terms of like, you know, I find myself scrolling, doom scrolling or whatever for like, you know, literally sometimes for like half an hour, I'm sat there and I'm like, suddenly I'm back in the room and I'm like, Jesus, I've just wasted half an hour. Like I haven't really learned anything. And that's one of the most frustrating things for me, is the time where you're just like, you know, reading tweets, like little sound bites of things. You're not learning, like the things like this, you know, long form conversation, like sitting down, reading a book or reading an article, like those things now seem like such an effort. And I have to put that time in my schedule. Otherwise, all those moments of freedom to do these things are taken up with just like sound bite, scroll, oh, argument, scroll, oh, that drama, scroll, you know, it's just... It's exhausting, really. I think, especially with Twitter at the moment, like I don't know how long you've been away, but the default for you homepage, instead of the following page, it actually defaults to for you now. So you're just offered up, you know, things that obviously the algorithm thinks you're going to be into. And it's so interesting how much of it is drama and how much of it is actually completely unrealistic and abnormal in terms of like how we would normally speak to each other, you know, how we speak to each other in the real world. I mean, obviously I think there's probably a slight decline there as well in the real world, but like, it's just weird to me to think that people, you know, young people growing up now, I really hope they don't think that that's the norm, just to be constantly argumentative, constantly take everything in bad faith. It's just utterly exhausting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm trying to limit it, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, exhausting is right. There's been some amazing studies recently, and I go off on tangents if I'm reading about something at the moment, but there's been amazing studies recently about the plasticity of our brains, about the fact that for a long time it was kind of thought, oh, if I have tendencies towards overthinking or depression, then that's just how my brain is, I can't do anything about it. Or if I'm an introvert, then that's just how my brain is, I can't do anything about it. There's been all these studies about how that's wrong, and there is this amazing plasticity to our brains that allow us to mold it and stuff. But one of the things that they've also found is the kind of two halves of the brain thing is, it's kind of a myth because they work together, but what we're really understanding more now is that one half largely has language and one half does not. So it's harder to track and read. And like, I want to get into it, but after reading all of this, but part of nurturing and allowing the half of the brain that doesn't have language as much, which is there for contextualizing and analyzing and putting things in the right position for the other half to then deal with, rather than it just constantly being analysis, is downtime. So meditation is finding periods to allow your brain to switch off and not be focusing on anything other than breathing or something like that, even not mantras and things. And reading that just made me think, I honestly don't think my brain's had any of that time in decades, because if I'm not listening to a podcast or sitting on social media, I'm watching TV or I'm overthinking things, there's no point that there isn't a voice in my head if it's my voice or the voice of social media. And yeah, it's really interesting to see that. Again, you look back to when we have all of the great breakthroughs in history and in the human brain, they're all periods where there would be these periods of downtime, of non-interruption. Yeah, it's an interesting one. And again, I think it's easier said than done, right? It's really hard, particularly in touring business and things like that. It's really hard to have those periods where you're not thinking about tomorrow's gig, or the issue that you're having with this place, or the ticket sales here, or whatever else. It's kind of, it's constant.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think it was Einstein who talked about the importance of, I'm trying to remember how he phrased it. It was either like no time or like nothing time or something which was, it's not even like, maybe he was unaware of like much of the sort of benefits of meditation or anything, but like, he just described it as just literally doing nothing and how important that is. And like, so not even like setting yourself a sort of meditative task, just sitting and seeing what arises, which, you know, is a form of meditation in itself. Even if you sort of don't plan it that way. And yeah, so it's just something that we're not taught to do. Yeah, not even, I think we all, even if it happens, if we sort of find ourselves daydreaming, like staring out a window or something, you can come away from that sometimes feeling refreshed without even, you're like, oh, you know, what just happened? That was black pill. And it's probably because your brain is like just gagging to be like, just let set free for a bit, you know, instead of just like either being used on some task or like getting lost in like anxiety, rumination, you know, whatever. But yeah, those moments are pivotal. I try and like meditation for me is something that I've tried to keep consistent for, well actually since 2015, 2016, it sort of became a tool in my toolbox that I've gradually started to learn over the years. But it is so hard to keep it consistent because there isn't really an innate, certainly not immediate reward to it. And a lot of people get into meditation because they think, oh, it's going to make me feel great. It's going to make me feel, you know, at ease and comfortable. And it can do, but also it might not. You know, it might just be a short escape and something that's quite hard and something you have to work at. And it's only after sort of months of it that you start to realize, you know, compare yourself to a few months ago, like, oh, actually, just in my general life, I'm more thoughtful, I'm more kind of engaged, I'm more focused, I'm more compassionate. You start to realize, oh, there's all these like things that have come out of that. But because it's such a long process sometimes, you don't think that those great results are because of the meditation. There's no immediacy to it. So you don't link the two, which is the reason why you stop being consistent in your meditation practice.
And then you drift back. It's a weird one because we've really built an immediacy-based society and immediate result, like we want a magic pill for everything, but just a results-based society. And I think that can be a bad thing in politics because I've had this argument before where there's been something that we're rallying against or protesting against or whatever, and someone kind of says, like, but what difference is it going to make? And it's like, well, doesn't have to, like, sometimes the right thing is just the right thing to do, even if you know you're going to lose. It's important to be in that fight just because for your soul, for who you are and for where you stand in society. So I think that's a worrying thing as well, and I think it is partly responsible for some of the political kind of acceptance of all the bad shit that goes on. because there is that, oh, what can we really do though? It's like at time, number one, we can make a difference. But number two, at times, it's not even about what difference can you make. It's about these people are wrong and you need for you to stand up and express that and get that out there. But yeah.
I mean, it's, I guess it's like nihilism, isn't it really? It's just that idea that we're completely powerless. What's the point? There's a couple of moments on the album where I really concentrate on power. The new album, latest album's not even out yet, but because it's just a fascinating thing. Like if you have power, and you know, looking at the people who have the most power, the most wealth today, you probably want your society to feel powerless, especially if you're a sort of authoritarian figure. The more people feel powerless, whether they are or they aren't, the less likely they are to act. And that's just like, for me, it's really formed how I think about like societies and how I think about activism and just that idea of the allure of nihilism and just drifting into, I am useless, worthless, you know, helpless. I can't change anything. That's exactly how the mindset that the, you know, power figures, I know it sounds rather reductive, like evil power figures, but like,
let's call them the Tories. We don't have to hide it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I completely agree. And it's an interesting one because as an example, I think there's tons of reasons for people not to vote if they choose to. I think there's, again, I don't think it's productive, but I think people can have valid reasons. For example, no, I'm not going to give an example actually, because it will just start more shit. But yeah, there are reasons to not vote. But the reason I won't accept is they're all the same, because they're categorically not all the same. Like UKIP are not the same as Labour. Does that mean I think Labour are great at the moment? Nah, but they're not the same. And the Tories aren't the same as Labour. It's like, that's the one argument I won't accept. And the reason I rally so hard against it is because it's the argument that I had as an anarchistic teen, as a growing up as a little punk, oh, they're all the same. And then you realise, no, I remember going years ago, going with Billy Bragg, knocking on doors in Raynham and Romford to get the current, to make sure the current racist party, it was Nick Griffin and his lot, to make sure that they don't get elected. And you talked to people in those communities and Nick Griffin and his lot, you know, actively harassing, actively just making their lives miserable. That's different from Labour's uselessness at the moment or whatever else. Like there are parties that will actively attack and damage areas of society. And that's different from whatever you think of the other parties. It's it's a weird one.
I think the only way that I've begun to think about it is separating my kind of desire for progress from politics, basically, and from voting. So like, I feel like the sort of rational thing to do is just vote for the marginal betterment of society. So vote for Labour, even though I feel utterly uninspired by Starmer. And then that, you know, that's just one act. That's not where my influence ends, you know. And then I just turn, okay, I've done that. That's done. And now what can I do to actually, you know, do my bit to improve society?
It was easy example. It was important to get Biden in. Now it's important to keep a boot on his neck as such, because he's not doing, he's again, there's ups and downs, but there's no longer that illusion of you get the Tories out and the game's won and we all cheer and go off. It's like, as you say, that's act one. I think that's the perfect way of putting it. That's the first step. And then
I don't think, you know, it's kind of trite, but like, I don't think the change we need is going to come from the top. Like, it's just as simple as that, really. Like, that's what I think, because I have been on both sides of that argument. Like, you know, I know I'm going to vote green because that's probably where I'm most aligned, even though that would be a wasted vote, so to speak. I've been on that side of it. Yeah, been on the sort of just going to vote Labour because it's marginally better. But yeah, at the end of the day, that's not going to make much difference, unfortunately. Like, the power structure is so strong, so cemented in our minds that like it's going to protect itself regardless of who is in power. So it's elsewhere that I think change is going to come. So
and people don't seem to realize how far the Tories have gone in recent years and how untouchable they seem to feel. The fact that really brought it home to me was seeing earlier this week Theresa May in the Houses of Parliament arguing that these new immigration laws are illegal, are unacceptable, and all this. And it's like, I think back to when Theresa May was in power and thinking she's the worst, this is terrible. And you think that she's now on, you know, she's now the reasonable voice in this thing. Because through the Boris and Rishi and kind of that week that Truss was the one, they've just got more, or through getting away with so many more scandals and so many more things, they've got more and more just outlandish and kind of like, oh, we'll just do this. And obviously having to appeal more to the extreme sides of politics. And it's a fucking horrible mess.
There's that classic, the Overton window, isn't it? They've just like shifted everything to the right. So those who were formerly the devil now seem rather angelic.
The one good thing that Trump did is make people aware of what the Overton window is and how that works. Because he was a big one on that. Because of such extreme claims and stupid things, it was the easy example. And let's move away from this for a little bit, because it's going to get heavy. We spoke a little bit about social media and about how people communicate. You're someone I'm a fan of. I consider you a pal. Event Shikari come up in conversation. I'm like, oh yeah, I know. Like, I know Ru. I looked and the last time I reached out to you was to let you know I really liked your new haircut. And I'm both sad and happy about that because I'm happy that that's a joyous thing. I'm so excited. Like, I'm liking things and that. But when you first went over to this like mad mullet, I was like, mate, I need to let you know I am all over this. This is the one. So
excellent.
I enjoy that level of communication. But I think communication is an interesting thing because of the pandemic as well. How was that period for you, again, as a person and as a musician, a band, you know, an act who go out on the road and share these interactions with thousands of people all the time? It seems... In my touring days, people would ask how you play the same songs every night or whatever, and does it get boring? It's like, no, but there's a different crowd every night. So it's genuinely different every night because that connection is different. Something makes a different song pop and things like that. How was that lockdown period, that pandemic period for you? And then we'll get into coming out of it because that was also key for you guys as a band.
Yeah, it was weird. It was disorientating. It was quite scary. Well, obviously it was for all of us, but like, yeah, specifically for me, my thing was that I basically lost the ability to write music, which was so strange. Like, I've been lucky, like, as a songwriter, I'm sort of the type of songwriter that can always write. I mean, it might not always be good, but like, that's for the filter. But yeah, and you know, I've written music, written something new every week of my life since I was 10. I think I started writing music with Chris, our bassist. And yeah, so for that year and a half, as soon as we stopped playing shows, you know, we released our previous album, Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible, right at the start of the first lockdown. So that was a just thoroughly weird experience, you know, not being able to kind of tour that, not being able to celebrate it. You know, our album release party was on Zoom.
Wow.
It was just like, just really depressing, you know. Yeah. After you put, you know, your soul into an album, making something for over a year.
As independent kind of artists as well, you'll know from day one, the only control you have is getting out on the road and getting it in people's ears and getting in people's towns to let people know about it if you've not got the budgets to have billboards all over the place. So to have put all this time into an album and then go, all right, now it's just we hope people hear about it. We hope the algorithm allows people to hear about it as such.
Yeah, yeah.
It's mad.
It definitely gave us like such a sense of gratitude for our like our real kind of core supporters because they were brilliant. They just sort of took over the job of our PR basically. Yeah. Because that was the only way. It was back to word of mouth really. Yeah, so it was a very strange time and losing that outlet, you know, that sense of like writing music is how I sort of structure my thoughts about myself, about the world. You know, it's an obvious sense of catharsis. It's my creative outlet as a sort of creative person. So to take that away was just very strange. And I had a bit of almost like an identity crisis, you know, because we weren't playing shows and I wasn't writing music. So when Shikari was dead, it was a non-entity. And since I was 16, 17, I have been Ralph from Shikari. So I was just suddenly like, who am I? What, you know, what is going on? So a lot of the stuff on the new album is very much kind of soul searching, thinking about identity and everything over that period. So it was pretty grim, especially that it's like, I know that I think it was the minority of people who experienced it like I did in terms of like creatives, or it certainly seemed that way. Cause you know, you're sort of scrolling through your friends and your peers on social media and everyone was in the studio. Everyone was being super productive, bringing out this and that. And I was just like, shit, there's just me in my garden trying to stay sane by growing veg and reading. And I mean, luckily I wrote the sort of accompanying book for the last album. And that was basically where I just poured all my kind of energy. Cause that just involved a lot of research, so I could do that. But in terms of writing music, I couldn't. So it was a strange period.
And how was it to come out of that? Cause you guys headlined the Download Festival pilot event, which was like the first UK live event in the wake of the pandemic. How was that? Cause seeing that happening, it struck me as a weird one because it's like, right, this is so essential and so needed, but also kind of scary because are we ready? Is it the right thing to do to be coming out of it? Is this the right time? All these, this kind of mix of emotions, again, because of the way our government handled this pandemic, it wasn't necessarily simply a celebratory, it's all over now. It was can we do this? How do we live? So yeah, how was that as an experience?
I mean, yeah, it was a total cocktail of emotions. Yeah. I mean, of course, it was madly euphoric because everyone just felt like they'd been caged and suddenly let out. So the whole festival site was this menagerie of mayhem. But yeah, at the same time, it was just like there was that sense of, should we be doing this? I mean, after, I think everyone sort of hushed up that the fact that there was a lot of transmission of COVID over that festival. But yeah, I suppose it was at that point where, you know, everyone was starting to be vaccinated and stuff. And it was, there was like glimmers of hope and it felt like, it just felt like a relief, you know, just to be back in a muddy field again. And to be, you know, to see friends in all walks of life, but friends in other bands. And it was also a great celebration of like British talent because it was a fully British bill. So it was, my head was exploding with trying to sort of what perspective to take up. But on the day, it was just a blur of euphoria. Yeah. I think, you know, when you've done so many shows, they do blur into each other a lot. But like, I remember when we played the Dreamers Hotel, which was when we played the Dreamers Hotel live for the first time. So a year and a half after we released it, which I hate because I always feel like you don't truly know a song until you play it live. You know, 100%. That's where it sort of finds itself. And that moment I'll never forget. That's burned into my memory because the energy was just incredible. And I can remember walking off stage and we were like quite tearful really because it was just like such a release. And it wasn't like suddenly I could write music again, but that was kind of the turning point where I was like, okay, I felt like I've received that sense of purpose, that sense of human connection, felt that energy again. And I felt just the little sprinklings of like, oh, a little urge to like write and like, oh, I've got an idea. And so that was a massive relief as well.
It's mad to have had all of those feelings all come back at once and realise it was that kind of connection that was missing. But I mean, I also want to add, if I didn't feel it was a massive cash, or if I didn't feel it would look like a massive cash grab, I would have re-recorded every album I ever did just after the album's promotional tour because I completely agree. I feel the songs change completely. I need a month of doing it. I need a month with those songs on the road. And then it kills me if the original song comes on because I'm like, no, that's not how it goes. That's not how that song's meant to go. Fuck, that's how you all hear it. No. I forgot that. It's changed now. So, yeah. It's weird how music can work. But, I mean, that connection then must have inspired A Kiss for the Whole World because that album, the new album, is about reconnecting and restating your claim and falling back in love with what you've been missing, has been missing from your life. So how were those emotions to go through, I guess, on performatively? Like, again, it's a weird thing with writing from your heart, because you, for me, and I want to hear how it is for you, for me, it's a deep experience in the writing, and then as soon as that's nailed down, it kind of takes it away from me. It's handed over. It now belongs to the audience or to the song or to the beat or whatever else. So how was that for you? Because clearly, as said, emotional times, fuck, leading up to the pandemic, during the pandemic, you know, and all of that. How was that to write kind of positively about connection? And did you get to keep hold of those emotions?
Yeah, I found it was a similar experience to our previous album, The Spark, because I found that everything I was writing was really quite overtly positive and upbeat and energized and just like exciting. And it's only sort of retrospectively, I suppose, that I've realized it's because I was excited. I was excited to write again. Yeah. And for me, one of the most like palpable feelings is relief. Mm. Like, you know, whether it's like, I don't know, you've had like a medical scare, but then it's going to be okay. Or someone you know has, but then they're going to be okay. Or, you know, something to do with your job or livelihoods, whatever. But like when you experience relief, for me, that is like, it can be almost crippling euphoria. And that's what I experienced when I started being able to write again. And again, not immediately. It wasn't like, you know, open the curtains one day and all this music started flooding in. But as I started to build up a kind of arsenal of like new ideas and new tracks started to form, I was like, oh my God, okay, I can write again. Like I haven't lost it forever. Cause I genuinely thought like during the lockdown, I mean, none of us knew what was going to happen in the world. And I didn't really know whether I would be writing again, whether I'd have the urge or the ability or the will, you know, that just everything had just been sucked out of me. So yeah, that sense of relief was just massive. And yeah, therefore the real thrill of writing music had never been as strong. And after I'd written like the bulk of the music, I was reading Henry David Thoreau, Walden, Into the Woods. And I was just thoroughly inspired by that, which was strange, I guess, a period coming out of a lockdown when we're living our solitary lives. I wanted to recreate it and what he did and go and live in the woods. But yeah, that's what we did. We hired a very old, dilapidated farmhouse down on the South Coast in the middle of nowhere, like nothing for like 2 miles around us, completely off grid, ran on solar power, so we couldn't boil a kettle and record a guitar at the same time.
I love it.
It couldn't take it. So and just, you know, we were cooking for each other, chopping wood to keep us warm because there was no central heating, and recorded the album. And it was just such a beautiful experience. It was just the four of us and our engineer George, and it just felt like, it really, as you say, it's like reconnection, a rebirth, really, of what Anish Kari was, especially after going through that period of thinking it was all over.
That's amazing, and it's really interesting to hear that kind of the gradual return after feeling it was all gone. How did that play into collaborations? Because again, collaborations can often involve a level of imposter syndrome or nerves or whatever else, but particularly if you've gone through kind of losing the ability to write. And the Void Stares Back with Wargasm, who are amazing, and then The Ball, with Cody Frost, who I was unaware of until you slung that video up. And I was like, who is this being? Like, the most engaging, it was absolutely blew me away. How were those kind of things when you've gone through that period of not being sure who you are, you know? Because who you've always been stopped for a while.
Yeah. It's taken me a long time to be comfortable with collaborations, because, you know, even with the band, like I'm the songwriter, so I'm like I'm writing. It's a very solitary, emotional experience for me. So I think it wasn't until it was a couple of years, was it before the pandemic? Yeah, 2018, 2019, where I did a lot of pop writing and just like pushed myself to write outside of Shikari. And it was a fascinating experience for many reasons, many negative, but I learned that it just boosted my confidence at the end of the day. And I was like, okay, I can, even though I'm can be quite socially awkward and introverted, I can sit in a room and I can contribute and I can feel comfortable eventually. It's not easy, but I can do it. So yeah, that just propelled me really to collaborate more. And you know, it's not like we kind of sent the line out to people that we didn't really know that well. We were already friends with Wargasm. We've known Cody for 10 years. She started coming to our shows a long time ago. So they were like, you know, they weren't daunting figures to approach. So that always makes it easier when you already have a genuine connection with the other artist. And yeah, they were actually just both great experiences. Like the Wargasm one was really fun because they properly went in on it. You know, it's not like we just like gave them a verse or whatever. They did some production. Yeah. And both their vocals really added to the track. And that was because actually of the download pilot, because they were playing that. And that was, I think it might have been the first, maybe the second time I saw them. So they were sort of at the back of my mind as I was writing that track. And I was like, oh, I can hear their voices on this. And then, yeah, Cody, I mean, yeah, that was just like a no-brainer. I was writing Bull and I wrote that melody and I could just immediately hear her doing it. And she works with Dan Weller, who's a great friend of ours, has produced a load of our previous work. And so, yeah, that was just easy to do. And she absolutely nailed it. And she's on tour with us at the moment. Nice. And she's smashing it.
How was the journey into pop writing in that period? Because I think I find all that stuff really interesting. My only brief experience was a failed one, like really early on. It's not pop writing even, but writing for other people. Really early on, Liam Howlett reached out and wanted me to write some Prodigy stuff. And I wrote some Scroobius Pip stuff. And he kind of went back to him and he was like, this is dope, but it's not Prodigy stuff. And it was too early in my kind of career as an artist to understand that, right, I need to write in another mindset, I need to change my approach. I just went, yeah, well, give me some beats and I'll write how I write. And that was of no use. But yeah, how was that as an experience? I've never done anything like that's since. So it's always that, it's that failure that I learned so much from, if you know what I mean. Like I look at it positively, yeah, and as a beautiful thing, and me and Liam are still pals because of it. But yeah, how was that? How awesome was that experience?
Yeah, it's very strange. It was like a pushing myself out of my comfort zone thing, basically. And I did some stuff in Norway, like, you know, trying to get in with all the Scandi pop songwriters, because they're just, they basically own pop. And then like went to Poland, did a few tracks for some Polish pop artists and rock artists. And it was just a complete mixed bag, really. But the sort of main things I took away from it is sort of what I expected. Like, it is a conveyor belt. There is no sense of genuine artistic, like, I don't want to say merit because that's a bit harsh, but like giving, you know, there's no like presenting one's soul on a plate. Like, there's no poetry or real attempt at human connection. It's like, oh, this sounds good. Oh, what, you know, what words will fit this, and there's no will to storytell or to connect. So it was a bit soul destroying, but I still found it fascinating and sort of wanted to continue to learn more. But I guess it's just a completely different headspace. It's the true, you think of the art as a commodity. Yeah. You know, this is the thing that's going to get this artist to this point. You know, the manager wants, they give you like three reference tracks and they want something that sounds exactly like that, like literally. So it's just a very different experience, because I've always been the type of songwriter that likes experimentation. I get excited by exploring new ideas, new instruments, new genres. And that's how I write. And I like to have a very varied palette, because life is varied and I want to write about different emotions, different experiences. And this was just the total opposite. It was like imitation, really, and often like to the point of pastiche, where it's just like, this is a hit song at the moment. We think this artist can make a very similar thing and have some degree of success. Mm. We would like you to make this happen. That. Just odd.
Yeah.
Just very odd, you know, but like, I don't really do it anymore. I'd much prefer like getting in a room with an artist and getting to know them. And if there's a way I can help them reach, you know, whatever potential they want to reach, then I'm more than happy to be involved. But it's been an interesting learning process, really.
Stuff like that as an experience though, man, like to do those things. And even if you, again, it sounds like a weird comparison, but I moved into acting a fair few years back, and the big thing for me, as much as anything, has been reading up on stuff and finding the things I don't agree with or I don't connect with as much as the things I agree with. It's as exciting for me in a way to get through a whole book and go, nah, I didn't really connect with loads of that. There's one bit there, but I don't agree that this is this and all that. And I think those things can shore up your own artistry outside of it. So again, I'm sure all of that experience helped Shikari in a weird way, because it's just, right, that's not what I want. Yeah. But I did like that part about it. And this small bit here was really interesting. You spoke about writing from the heart. And I remember talking, again, early days to Billy Bragg. I'm going to start wrapping this up in a minute, I promise. And he was saying how weird it is that people think of him as a political songwriter, because there's one, maybe two political songs on every album. All the rest are about love and about emotions and mental health. And I connect that with you guys, because again, I'll think of you, I guess partly because of activism and stuff like that, but I'll think of you guys as very political. And then I'll think through a lot of the songs and go, well, there's not that many of them that are actually overtly political. How is that and why is that? Because I know for me, like, I have people ask every time there's a big political thing happen, because I had a few political songs, I'll have people kind of say, oh, you need to come back and you need to write about this. And the reason it doesn't appeal at all is, sadly and depressingly, every political song I wrote still applies. Every angry political song I wrote 10 years ago, it's still valid. And that breaks my heart. I dream of the time it's irrelevant and it doesn't make any sense. But it's like, I've got nothing to add to that. I've already said that we should be picking up bricks and smashing things. It's like, that's as far as I could go. There's not a lot more I can say on this. So how is that for you guys? And how is it as people, like, as a responsibility to be a political voice and to make a stance?
Well, yeah, I feel an immense amount of pressure. I think that was possibly one of the things that also held me back from writing. You know, every time something happens in the world, I get like a load of tweets or, you know, pictures, people saying, oh, I can't wait to hear the next Enya Shikari album. It's going to be great. And it's just like, oh, that's a small consolation for all this shit
I'm
that
really
we're going
sad.
Through, isn't it?
Like,
My mind's just gone completely blank.
Yeah, the reason your mind's gone blank is because I talked for ages and didn't really frame any of it as a question. So that's completely on me, my friend. How do you feel as with that pressure to be a political band when you are also a band who writes about mental health, about connection, about love, about all these other things? And they don't seem to, I think why a lot of bands will steer more into that in their later careers, because there doesn't seem to be pressure on that. It's your personal outpouring. Whereas with political stuff, as you say, every time something will happen, people will be ready for you, for your response or your reaction. And how do you find that pressure?
Yeah, well, I think we've had twists and turns with even just the being framed as a political band or whatever. You know, we used to just, I remember when the second album came out, which was when the lyrics became a lot more overtly political, and we were just like, we just called it the P word. And so as soon as you say that in an interview, people switch off. And so we just like, we don't want to be known as that. And like, when people hear politics, they just think of old white men bickering, like that, you know, in suits and in wigs or whatever else. You know, it's a really sort of outdated thing, and it kind of drives people away. Whereas, you know, what we're interested in is getting people more involved, which seems such like a foreign thing these days, because we're all so removed from politics. You know, as we spoke about earlier, we get to vote every 4 or 5 years, whatever, depending on what country. But, you know, we would be much more interested in a more deliberative, contemplative, however you pronounce that word, democracy, you know, where we're all way more involved. And that's the norm. It's not something that we run away from because it's just full of money and corruption and what it is today. So yeah, I don't know. I just write about everything. Like, I suppose on that second album, I was extremely angry, and that's a powerful motivating emotion, and you write about things that make you angry. And I suppose that's how we became to write about politics, because that's what was making me angry. And then, you know, you live your life, you experience this and that, and then you end up writing about all sorts of other things. And that, you know, that's what drives me, as I was saying earlier. Like, it's the broadness of the palette that keeps me as thrilled to write as the first day I picked up a pen or a guitar. You know, it's if I was writing the of a much more hemmed in sort of reduced version of what Nishikori is now, I don't know whether I could be as hopefully authentic as we are now, because I'm sure I would be slightly bored. I mean, if you're doing anything over and over and over again, you will get bored. It will become banal. Or at least you're, you know, what we normally say is you become an actor rather than a musician. Yeah. And that scares me a lot. And that's something that I think certainly subconsciously I'm able to avoid it because of my upbringing, and I was inspired by so many different types of music, and I was very lucky to have all of these types of music thrown into me. So it's within me to have this broad palette. But I think it is also a conscious thing, because I know if I'm not working with a broad palette, I'll feel, you know, like someone's putting a dam up in front of me, and I can't use the full breadth of inspiration that I want to use.
I love that, and it's beautiful to hear and see and feel that passion and excitement coming across when you are 20 years into being in the Shikari. That's an amazing thing. So to kind of wrap things up, yeah. I guess, what's ahead? What do you see as the next 20 years? You don't have to go into the full 20 years, but yeah, what's ahead for you and for the band, man?
Well, we certainly only, take it, you know, a day at a time, a week at a time, which is sometimes to our detriment, I think. But at the moment, we're looking at Sam Dunk.
Yes,
we're working on the production and the set for that. I think that's going to be our most ambitious show ever. There's a lot of thought that's going into that one. And then, it'll just be, you know, touring the world, which still seems like a ridiculous sentence to say, you know. We're off to Japan in a few weeks, which is, I remember the first time we went there and I was like, what am I doing here? And it sort of still feels like that, you know. This is a place that I'd never thought I'd go to. The furthest afield I went before the band as a kid was Guernsey. Yeah. and then here I am about to go to Japan for the seventh, eighth time or something. So it's, it's going to be a very, very busy year. Yeah, looking forward to it, / anxious about the amount of sleep deprivation and intensity it's going to be.
But it's going to be an intense one. But again, in a way, there's been some experiences there that will have re-energized you to appreciate all of it and to be in that zone. But I appreciate you taking the time, man. As I said, it's always a pleasure to catch up, and it's been absolutely far too long. So thank you for taking the time.
No, thank you so much. Thanks for having me again. Really appreciate it.
No problem, mate.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Rao. I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you all remember how to say Rao's name now. I'm banging on about it again, but the funny thing is I've gone back and listened, and at the start of that original episode, I say I'm joined by Rao Reynolds. Is it Rao? Is Rao right? So I got it right the first time. Rao confirmed I had it right, and then somehow my dumb brain has second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh guessed itself to be bowling about calling him Rue. Anyway, Rue is that the name of Zendaya's character in Euphoria? That's not a bad mishap then. That's a great character, a great performance. Anyway, I'll be back next week. Oh, how good was that Brandon Cronenberg episode last week? I was really pleased with that. I was really excited to talk to that dude. If this is your first time tuning in, go back and listen to our previous episode and just have a dig through the back catalogue, I guess. There's been loads of good people. Anyway, I'll talk to you soon. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.